them in the near future. He departed, leaving the delectable detective behind. She smiled and said, "What was that all about?" I assumed she was talking about my interlude with Ethan. "Oh, nothing," I said, losing myself for an instant in her eyes. "Ethan wanted me to put him in touch with my interior designer. We have similar appreciation for feng shui." I don't think she believed me. Anyhow, an awkward moment followed where the two of us just stood there in silence. I mentally put my hands in my pockets and started whistling. Erica made a motion to her hip, and I silently hoped she would pull her gun and put me out of my misery. No such luck. She did remove a card from her back pocket and handed it to me. She said, "Give me a call if you think of anything else, or if you just want to grab a cup of coffee." This last sentence could carry multiple meanings, and I wasn't sure if I was ready for any of them. I held onto the card and watched as Erica retreated down the steps. A whirlwind of lights cascaded from the street, and I wondered what time the news stations would pile it in. I closed the door and surveyed the card Erica had given me. It had all the pertinent information on how to track down Erica Frost should one need to track down Erica Frost. It even had a number written in pen, which I guessed was her private home number. I stuck the card in my pocket and walked into the kitchen. I picked up one of the discarded crusts from the pizza box and heaved myself onto the center island. I played the last 12 hours over in my head, pondering things big and small. Mostly I thought about the four women who had touched my life in the last 12 hours. Lacey Prescott, Alex Toombs, Erica Frost, and Ellen Gray. I saw this radar screen with these four blips. One blip was unwavering, right in the center. One was headed outward to the outermost concentric circle, moving slowly but steadily from the heart. Then there were these two blips just on the outskirts, their pulses weak, barely detectable. My eyes glazed over and I shook my head. The clock above the stove hit midnight. My 33rd Thanksgiving was finally over. What a day. Chapter 8. I pulled the thick red curtains in the dining room aside. The window was cold and clammy, and my breath fogged against it. I rubbed the moisture clean with my forearm and peeked out at an angle. It was dark for 10 in the morning. I'm guessing this was directly related to the thick cloud cover and persistent drizzle. The big tree in my front yard swayed in the morning breeze, its barren branches clawing at the cold air. Wrapped around the tree's thick trunk was yellow crime scene tape, death ribbon. It ran across the drive, wrapped around the mailbox, then wrapped around the far post of the gated entrance. I watched as a man with a camera was ushered under the billowing ribbon by a man with a clipboard. I could make out a throng of onlookers at the far edge of the street. Twos and threes huddled under umbrellas watching the fiasco unfold. Didn't these people have shopping to do? Seriously, go to Target. I released the curtain and walked into the kitchen. What I really wanted were some waffles and some apple cider and a newspaper. I was curious what the byline on the front page would read. It could read something as simple as "Governor Murdered," or something cliched like "Black Friday," or something witty like "A Gray Day for Washington." Then again, maybe there was an even bigger story, one that trumped Ellen Gray's murder, and the headline read, "Thomas Prescott is back." I rifled through the cupboards. Slim pickings, unless you like corn. I did not. The untouched box of cinnamon breadsticks lay on the counter, and I ate a couple. I peeked around the curtains again close to noon, and the melee had only increased. The story was now national news, and every affiliate west of the Mississippi had a warm body in the street with a microphone. The hours crept by. I spent a couple in the basement looking through boxes. I spent a couple cleaning. I ate some corn. I flipped through a couple dusty newspapers my dad had kept. Mount St. Helens is going to erupt to 1980, if you're curious. Many will die. I did some stretching. I ate some more corn. I played myself in chess a couple times. One time I lost. Go figure. I found an old Game Boy and played some Tetris. I ate more corn. Saturday was much the same. The crowds had thinned in the streets by half. The story was quickly losing its momentum. As for me, I was going stir-crazy, and my thumbs were sore from Tetris, and I was out of AA batteries, and my ass was chafed from shitting corn. By noon on Sunday, I had a serious case of cabin fever. The street action had died down, like last call at a bar, and only the true diehards remained. I wasn't overly concerned with running into a cop or even a reporter, for that matter, but I didn't want to stumble into any of the curious neighbors. Lots of questions I didn't want to deal with. What are you doing back, Thomas? Why did you leave in such a rush, Thomas? What's that rash from, Thomas? What's the square root of 632, Thomas? I'd rather not. I went out the back deck and wound my way through the foliage until I came to Route B. From there, I found the frontage road and kept on for a good 2 miles. Fisherman's Terminal is a 5-block stretch dedicated to fishermen and their boats. The large port is home to over 700 ships, ranging from 40-footers to 130-footers. The boats fish for anything from sardines to Alaskan king crab. Lined up side by side are a half-dozen fisheries, a couple boat repair shops, bait and tackle, fill-up stations, anything and everything a fisherman might need. Intermixed are a handful of Seattle's best restaurants and pubs. Everything is built on stilts and everything hangs out over the water. One pub is the Flounder, which is ironic considering there are over 1,000 different species of fish in the nearby waters and Flounder isn't one of them. A decent number of boats were tied up to the dock, and about twice as many cars were parked in the dirt drive. I walked up the long gangplank, the low tide visibly churning through each open gap in the wood. I pushed through the door, and the aroma of stale peanuts overwhelmed my senses. At the Flounder, it was standard procedure to fill up a bowl of peanuts from the large barrels near the entrance and proceed to discard the shells on the dusty wooden floors. I crunched my way across the discarded shells, underfoot, past a beer-stained pool table, past the quintessential golden tea and buck hunter machines, and sat down at one of 2 empty tables. 40 or so people were scattered about, mostly men. I'd say the demographic was 70% fishermen and 30% guys stealing away from their in-laws to watch the Seattle Seahawks game. I bet half the guys here were out to get more ice. A young woman approached my table. She was wearing shorts meant for summer and a small red t-shirt meant for a third grader. The t-shirt read, "I found her at the Flounder." Clever. The waitress's name was Josie. I ordered a fish sandwich and a beer, watched the game, and ate peanuts. Was I a guy's guy or what? It was the middle of the third quarter and the Seahawks had the ball. I could name a couple of the more popular players, but most of the names the announcer was throwing out were new to me. My dad, who had been one of the more diehard Seahawks fans on the planet, would be rolling over in his grave. The Seahawks made a field goal to go up 31-3, and as they were kicking off to San Fran, my food came. I ordered another beer and asked the increasingly friendly Josie, "Do you know why fish are so skinny?" She shook her head. "They eat fish." Josie thought this was incredibly funny and that I was a regular riot. I had a third beer and my brain started to wander a bit. Here it was, the Sunday after Thanksgiving, and for some reason I was back in Seattle. I was surrounded by the crew of the Deadliest Catch. I'd eaten half my weight in peanuts. I just flirted with a girl 10 years my junior, and the Seahawks were kicking the shit out of the 49ers. Hell, I don't think I could have been more confounded if I woke up at fucking Hogwarts. The Seahawks game ended at 5:15. Seahawks won 38-10, and the 5 o'clock news came on. A quick post-game locker room report led off, followed by the weather. The TV was muted, but according to the closed captioning, rain was probable for the next 5 days. Weathermen in Seattle were about as necessary as a gallbladder. After a commercial break, they flashed to the news desk. A nice-looking woman in a tan jacket started spouting. I wasn't really paying attention until the words, "Governor Ellen Gray," appeared at the bottom of the screen. They quickly breezed over the governor's disappearance and how her body was found. I assumed I was the local man who had stumbled upon the governor's body. I thought local man who risked life and limb to pull the governor's body from the raging surf had a better ring to it, but I wasn't going to split hairs. Like all closed captioning, the words on screen were 3 seconds behind the actual words being spoken, and by the time the words, "Here are just some of News 5's favorite memories of the governor," popped up, a photo of Ellen Gray was on screen. She appeared to be in her late 40s. She was beautiful. Dark hair. Dark eyes. Demi Moore could play her flawlessly in the made-for-TV movie that no doubt was already in the works. The photo montage continued. There was a picture of the governor running in the race for the cure, throwing out the first pitch at a Mariners game, cutting a ribbon in front of what looked to be an enormous library, astride a horse speaking to a group of protesters, reading to a group of small children, getting blood drawn at the health fair, at a food drive. The next picture was a shot of hundreds of uniformed men trudging through the thick brush of a mountainside. Then a shot of a jam-packed Quest Stadium, which I surmised was the public funeral Erica had spoken of. The last picture was a shot of the cove where I'd pulled out her body. They cut to a young woman walking out of a gray brick building. I recognized the building as the Seattle Police Department headquarters. The woman had her hair pulled back in a tight ponytail and was clad in tan slacks and a blue SPD jacket. She was what we call dressed to bust balls. More significantly, she was Erica Frost. I leaned forward. Earlier today, a representative from the Seattle Police Department spoke to reporters. Erica had about 10 microphones shoved in her face. She had just finished a statement and now looked to be taking questions. Reporter, is Adam Gray your prime suspect? Erica, at this time we have no suspects. Adam Gray is just one of a couple persons of interest we're looking into. This is an extremely high-profile case, and we are looking at all possible scenarios. We'll know more in a couple of days. Another reporter. When will Adam Gray be arrested? Erica, don't get ahead of yourself. He might never be arrested. Like I said, we are looking into all possible scenarios. I highly doubted this. In fact, I had a strong premonition Erica Frost, the Seattle Police Department, and the state of Washington were putting all their bread in one basket. Adam Gray. Erica, rest assured the Seattle Police Department is doing everything in its power to bring Ellen Gray's killer to justice. Whoever they are, wherever they are, they will be found. That's a promise. She had me convinced. If I killed Ellen Gray, I'd be on the red eye to Guam. The Seattle Police Department could do worse than Erica Frost as a spokesperson. I could relate. I'd done my fair share of PR in my day. I think it had something to do with my rugged good looks, soft-spoken manner, and the ability to lie on cue. I'd been good. Erica was better. It had to be burning Ethan up that Erica was in front of the camera and not him. I wonder what higher-up had made this decision. Regardless, they wrapped up Erica's soundbite and returned to the female anchor. Adam Gray was questioned and released after the disappearance of his wife on October 15th. They cut to a picture of Governor Gray arm-in-arm with the gentleman at what I guessed was a fundraiser of sorts, or a gala. I'd never been to a gala, and I wasn't exactly sure what constituted a gala, but this had gala written all over it. The gentleman, who I speculated was Adam Gray, was a large man of about 50. He had thinning salt-and-pepper hair, an emphasis on salt, and a well-trimmed white goatee. He had piercing green eyes, like he'd slipped and fallen on two chunks of green amber. He wasn't attractive, but there was something attractive about him. They cut to Adam Gray standing in front of an immense wrought-iron gate. A colossal gray and baby blue estate was just visible, filling the background. Adam Gray made a statement at his Bainbridge Island estate just minutes ago. Adam Gray was holding two little girls' hands, both with brown hair like their mother's. They both wore dresses, one red, one purple. I put one at 7, the other at 5. Both girls looked rather uncomfortable. I wasn't sure if it was the cameras or if this was the first time they held hands with her father. After smiling at both his daughters, Adam's mouth began moving. I thought about that old joke. How do you know a lawyer is lying? His mouth is moving. I read his words at the bottom of the screen. This has been a trying last few days. Over the last 6 weeks, I have mourned the tragic loss of my beautiful wife, and these two precious girls have mourned the loss of a loving and devoted mother. Learning that Ellen's death was not an accident, but an intentional and malicious act, has left this family at a loss for words. We are overwhelmed by the outpouring of support from the grieving public. We, as you, demand answers. We demand this vile perpetrator be caught and punished. By the time I finished reading, the Seahawks coach was sitting behind a microphone on screen. I downed the last of my beer, overtipped Josie, and left. Chapter 9. I guess you could say Harold Humphreys dropped into my life rather unexpectedly. Early Monday morning, the plumber showed up. The plumber was not Harold Humphreys. The plumber's name was Theo. After about 2 hours of hard labor, $75 hours, Theo had fixed the brown water problem. Minutes after Theo had left, I heard a distinct ringing. It was a phone. I didn't remember seeing a phone, but the ringing seemed to be coming from upstairs. I ran upstairs and into Lacey's room. The ringing was coming from under her bed. I lifted up the bright flamingo pink bed skirt and extracted a bright flamingo pink phone. I picked up the receiver and said rather timidly, "Hello?" There was a slight pause at the other end. Then in a shallow, hoarse whisper, a man said, "Bobby?" This would be Harold. I said, "No, there's no Bobby at this number." "Oh, sorry." I'm not sure why I didn't hang up. To this day, I wonder what would have happened if I'd hung up that phone. Would he have called back? The man, Harold, though he'd yet to give me his name, took 5 deep breaths, then asked, "Who's this?" I wouldn't normally divulge my name to a complete stranger, but something about the voice drew it out of me. I told him my name. "Is that right?" Old people like to say, "Is that right?" At least my Grandpa Prescott had once upon a time. And this was all I had to go by. If I remembered correctly, it was rhetorical. I asked, "Who's this?" This would prove to be a grave mistake. And so Harold Humphreys told me who he was, in real time, because Harold's life was really, really long, and because Harold talked really, really slowly, and this took a really, really long time. I'd more or less stopped listening when he got up to the Battle of Bunker Hill. Then he said,
"I need some things."
He said, "Grab a pen." Unfortunately for me, there was a bright pink pen adorned with a flamingo, resting on Lacey's bright pink nightstand. I grabbed it. Harold proceeded to rattle off a list of supplies he needed. When he was done, I looked down at the list on my palm. Maxim, Sour Patch Kids, Red Bull, Macadamia Nuts, Big League Chew, Grape, Nestle Chocolate Chip Cookie Dough, and 3 lotto tickets. In a nutshell, a bunch of nursing home contraband. What were they going to do? Add a couple more years to a sentence? I told him to give me an hour. I made my way to the garage. There were 3 cars. My mom's BMW coupe, my dad's Lincoln Continental, and a Range Rover. I found a box of old towels and wiped the many layers of dust off each of the cars. My dad had bought the Lincoln just months before the crash, and it still looked brand new. But I opted for the Range Rover. I made a stop at the local grocery store and picked up Harold's items. Then it took me about 20 minutes to find the Willow Springs Retirement Community. The place was all stucco, with a bunch of trees that were not indigenous to the Seattle area, making it look like some sort of an all-inclusive club. I think they were trying to trick these old folks into thinking they had come to die in Key West. I found a parking spot and hopped out. I had no idea what the visitor policy was at Willow Springs, so I dressed up a bit. Tan slacks and a blue polo. A bit baggy, seeing as they were my father's. In addition, I was carrying an old briefcase which contained Harold's nefarious items. I walked through the double doors and was struck by the stench of old. Antiseptic meets dried apricots. Speaking of dried fruit, I told the prune at the front desk I was here to see Harold Humphreys. She eyed the briefcase suspiciously. I had a feeling this wasn't the first time old Harold had tried to pull one over on the headmistress. I signed in, then was directed to the 3rd building on the left, after the fountain. If I hit the hanging lanterns, I had gone too far. Was it just me, or was this place starting to feel a little too much like Vegas? I made it to Harold's room and knocked. 2.5 minutes later, the door creaked open and Harold peeked out. Harold was probably 5'8" in his prime, but his height was now at a right angle. He had these huge ears, the size of tea saucers, and I imagine if he wasn't bone deaf, he could hear from miles. Not a single hair adorned his shiny scalp, which, with the age spots, looked remarkably like a globe. There was a big brown spot near his crown that could have passed for Australia. He had large glasses perched on a bulbous nose, with lenses that gave the Hubble telescope a run for its money in thickness. The skin around his neck was loose and free-flowing, like his Adam's apple was using it as a hammock. An oxygen tank rested on the front basket of his walker. All in all, I'd have to carbon date Harold right around 1,000 years old. He took 2 deep inhales of oxygen and said, "Did you get my stuff?" I held up the briefcase and said, "Right here." I added, "I forgot the condoms." He smiled and invited me in. I walked the small room while he inspected the contents of my briefcase. The room was that of a typical college dorm. Small bed, TV, chair, mini fridge, coffee table, small bath, bong in the corner. Just kidding. It was an oxygen tank. I surveyed Harold. He had a huge chaw of Big League Chew in his mouth and was flipping through Maxim with quite possibly the biggest grin in the history of time. The TV was set on horse racing, and I watched 3 races while Harold devoured the candy and the magazine. Glipperfoot won the 6th race, but I had my money on saddlebags. Harold turned his attention to the races and correctly guessed the next four. Then he said,
"Come on, I'll give you the grand tour."
The grand tour consisted of the library, a small room with about 30 novels, 20 of which were either W.E.B. Griffin or Nora Roberts. The theater, a 32-inch TV with four rows of chairs and a meager VHS library of classics. The deli, which was home to fun portions of sandwiches, bananas, pudding, crackers, cookies, and other assorted goodies. Harold loaded up his little basket with items, even forcing me to fill my pockets. The billiard room, which, as far as I could tell, had never played home to any sort of billiard activity. And, of course, the highlight of the tour, the common area. Filling the glorified living room were 20 people in all, broken up into three or four small groups plus a couple stragglers. A group of six men sat on the couch, watching television and bickering about this and that. Harold called them the CNN aisles. Witty. I was introduced to a group of ladies at a table playing bridge. Two Irises, two Blanches, two Merles, and a Naomi. I think back in the day they must have had a name wheel that parents spun right after delivery. Come on, $1. I mean, come on, Evelyn. We came full circle an hour later. If I thought I was done with Harold, I was wrong. He told me to sit. I sat. He hit mute on the television and plopped down in his chair. This process took all of 4 minutes, and I even took the liberty of diving into one of the half egg salad sandwiches in my pocket and a banana half. He stared at me with those big eyes, about the size of a half dollar behind his half-inch thick lenses, for a long while. Then he said,
"And I'm about to tell you I've never told anyone before. Never told any of my kids, neither of my wives, my priest, nobody."
I nodded.
He said, "I might not be around much longer."
I guess Harold was coming to terms with his mortality.
"I mean, I probably only have a good 10 years left."
Then again, maybe not. For the record, it wouldn't have surprised me if Harold had 10 breaths left. He pulled a handkerchief out, blew his nose, neatly folded the handkerchief back up, packed it away, and said,
"It's 1942. I just turned 18. And against my father's wishes, I enlisted in the war."
He took a deep inhale on his oxygen tank.
"It was late March. I got up real early. Had to be at the train station by 8. Wrote a letter to my pa and said goodbye to Jesse, our cow. Left all my candy out for my sisters, then took Pa's truck."
"You stole your dad's truck?"
"Sure did. But I didn't exactly steal it. Pa would get a ride into town the next day and pick it up from the train station. There was a train station not 15 miles from our small farm. See, back then, you leased acreage from the owners. We leased 75 acres from the Kings. They were old money, had a coming out the wazoo. They lived about 7 miles up the road, big mansion up on a hill. Passed it every time you went into town. There was a lake on their land, a small lake. You could see it from the road. Sometimes around Christmas, you would see some of the King kids playing on the lake. We didn't have the best road into town. After good rain, it would be almost impassable. But the road got better around the King place. It was gravel, much smoother."
He went on a small tangent about gravel and road conditions. Then he caught himself.
"But that's besides the point. As I was driving past the lake, I saw this dog, this big dog running across the lake. I slowed down. A girl at the edge of the lake was yelling at the dog, slapping her legs and such. I'd seen her before. She was one of the Kings. Didn't know her name at the time, but she was a pretty little thing, she was. Brown pigtails. Couldn't have been more than 15 at the time."
He had this big smile on his face. He patted my hand lightly, and I could feel his smile crawl inside of me.
"I couldn't take my eyes off her. Then I see her start screaming, and I look for the dog. Couldn't see him anywhere. Then I saw the break. He'd fallen through the ice."
He took a deep breath and continued,
"I pulled the car to the side of the road. The girl was frantic, screaming. I was 200 yards away, and I could hear her screams. I watched her for 30 seconds, then she did the unthinkable. She started onto the ice. I remember shaking my head and praying for her to go back. We'd had an unseasonably warm March, which is why the harvest would prove to be so good, and the lakes had started to thaw early.
I saw where this was going.
She slowly made it out onto the lake. She made it to the dog, and I saw her reach down. But the dog probably weighed more than her. Then she fell, just disappeared into the lake. I don't know if the ice caved in around her or if she fell in the same hole as the dog, but she disappeared.
He went quiet, had his eyes clenched tight, the lids of each eye kissing behind his mammoth lenses, looking like two sleeping millipedes. I knew he was back there. For the next few moments, Harold was 18 again. Harold didn't open his eyes for a couple minutes. Then it was 5. Then it was 10. Then the snoring began. I rummaged through Harold's basket and ate another half sandwich and another half banana. Then I had a pudding, tapioca. Then I flipped through Maxim. I watched horse racing until I correctly guessed a winner. Holla back, girl, in the 10th. Then I left. Chapter 10. A major storm settled in over Seattle and it poured for the next 7 days. Not that I was complaining. I had plenty to keep me occupied inside the house. My first project was the carpet. I ripped out the green shag and replaced it with a cinnamon spice. Next was the kitchen tile. I went with a slate blue, which I must say really brought out my eyes. The last project on my list was to paint. Today was the second Monday of December, the 8th. I wanted to get the painting finished up by the weekend, but then I'd be all out of projects. What would I do then? Maybe I would go visit Lacey for a week. Or maybe I'd sign up for one of those singles cruises. Or maybe I'd jump off the Seattle Bridge. I made it to the Home Depot in downtown Seattle by noon. There wasn't much of a Monday crowd, and I was out of there an hour later, toting 4 gallons of coffee brown. Speaking of which, I was craving a pumpkin spice latte. I grabbed an umbrella from the trunk of my dad's Lincoln and started walking. You don't have to go far in Seattle to find a Starbucks, and I found one within 2 blocks. They were still making the pumpkin spice latte, and I ordered a pumpkin cream cheese muffin to complement the beverage. Just opposite the Starbucks, there was a bus stop with all sorts of advertisements. One in particular caught my eye. It was on the right wall of the enclosure. In fact, it took up the entire right wall. The top copy read Adam Gray and Associates. Beneath it was a picture of Adam Gray holding a dictionary. Beneath that was the caption, "Guilty isn't in our vocabulary." Barf. A number of infractions were listed about which you should contact the firm, up to and including DUI, DWI, drug crimes, juvenile crimes, parole and probation, traffic violations, white-collar crimes, real estate, criminal law basics, and domestic violence. Some creative persons had added, sucking some dude off, fucking a dog to death, lighting a bitch on fire, shanking a fool, and pissing on a kitten. There was an address and small map at the bottom of the ad, 200 Park Avenue, which put the building 25 blocks from my present location. The building at 200 Park Avenue is one of several buildings making up Park Avenue Plaza. 10 stories of teal plate glass, no doubt housing orthopedists, plastic surgeons, real estate agents, dentists, and probably even a couple competing law firms. I pushed through the revolving doors and checked the building directory. Adam Gray and Associates was located on the 10th floor, the penthouse. I rode the elevator and stepped off. The 10th floor had walls a green color that reminded me of sweet pea risotto, and plush carpeting a dark plum, very soothing. Directly across from the elevator was an impressive marble slab with AGA stenciled in silver and black. It might well have read, "Welcome to the big leagues," or "Almost makes you glad you're in trouble." I found Adam Gray's office, which took up a third of the entire floor, and I pushed through the glass door. A large desk guarded double doors. An impressive blonde guarded the large desk. When I say blonde, I mean the platinum type, the kind that burns your retinas if you look directly at it for too long. She was wearing an operator-style headset, but I could make out the white cords of an iPod slithering their way up her neck. She had her head down, and as I approached, I noticed she was busying herself with one of those Sudoku things. The marble nameplate on the desk read Julia. She didn't look like a Julia. She looked like a Tiffany or a Posh. Posh tapped her pencil rhythmically on the desk to whatever was on her playlist. I'm guessing the pussycat dolls, then scribbled in a number. She then proceeded to flip her pencil over and aggressively erase her entry. I mentally tabulated her SAT score at 700. Posh was yet to notice my presence. I took two steps forward, bellying up to the desk, my shadow falling over her. She glanced up, yanked out her earphones, and smiled. I couldn't help but notice Posh's teeth were three shades too white, and it appeared she'd selected her nose out of a lineup. She said, "Oh, dear, you startled me. I didn't notice you come in. Welcome to Adam Gray and Associates. How can I assist you?" No, she didn't actually say this. She did say, "Where'd you come from? You need a lawyer?" "Lawyer came out lawyer. Make that SAT score 70. I said, "Is Adam in?"
Mr. Gray's in court today. Third day at the Proctor trial. Should wrap up on Thursday. He won't be back for another hour."
I nodded and said, "I'll just hang out if that's okay." She shrugged. I added, "You don't really strike me as a Julia." She looked at me like I'd just predicted her future. "You will go to the bathroom sometime between noon and six-ish." She said,
"How did you know?"
"I have a sixth sense for these things."
"My name is Sunny."
"And in Seattle, no less." She didn't get it, but maybe Sunny was her middle name. Maybe her first name was Partly. She said,
"They haven't made me a nameplate yet. This is my second week. Julia was the old receptionist. Her mom got really sick and she went to take care of her. I'm filling in till she gets back."
She shrugged and went back to her Sudoku. I turned and explored Adam Gray's waiting room. Two couches, charcoal, probably suede, were nestled around a giant flat screen. The TV was set to a slideshow, and I watched as a handful of Seattle's more picturesque landscapes flashed across the screen. An overhead shot of Quest Stadium lit up at night, a panoramic shot of downtown, the Space Needle just off-center, one of Elliott Bay, a seaplane just barely skimming the water. I watched the entire reel, probably about 20 pictures, until it started repeating. I plopped down on the couch and picked up a Forbes magazine from the coffee table. It was their 100 Most Powerful People in America issue. Of course. I flipped it open. Number one was Bill Gates, naturally. Two, Warren Buffett. Three, Oprah Winfrey. Four, LeBron James. I flipped to the back. Gray was number 97. Under his picture was the caption, "The Most Powerful Lawyer in America." It went on to name some of his biggest cases. He got his name defending a fraternity brother from Seattle Pacific who had gone on to become CFO of Sun Microsystems. The accused was charged with vehicular homicide, and the jury returned a verdict of not guilty, for which Gray was rumored to have made upward of $7 million in legal fees. He quickly became the must-have defender of the rich and famous. Forbes reported that in the last year alone he collected more than $13 million in legal fees, and his firm billed clients for more than $100 million. Gray owned 8 properties, a multi-million-dollar Bainbridge Island estate, the one he'd been standing in front of on television, a high-rise condo in the heart of Seattle, a lake house up in Edmonds, a condo in downtown Vancouver, a cozy place in the San Juans, a villa in Tuscany, a place in Kauai, and a farm in Virginia, as well as a 32-foot yacht, the Habeas Corpus. And get this, the guy did all his own research, didn't trust paralegals or secretaries to do anything. He was licensed to practice in Washington, California, New York, Massachusetts, and Florida, and it was rumored he was in the process of getting his barrister license in England. The article also mentioned he was married to Governor Ellen Gray, who also happened to make the Forbes list, only she was ranked a baker's dozen higher than her husband, or lower in this case. I flipped to number 84. The caption read, "Nothing Gray about her." The first thing that jumped out at me was Ellen's salary. Just over $160,000. This was probably less than the interest Adam accrued on his fortune each month. I found this ironic and slightly depressing. I skimmed the article. It highlighted Ellen's rise to power as well as the many contributions she had made to the community. The article likened Ellen Gray to Princess Di not once, but twice. Adam Gray might be the most powerful lawyer in America, but when it came to his own household, he was second fiddle, a regular Prince Charles. After 20 minutes, I made my way back up to the desk and said to Sunny, "I'm just going to wait for Adam in his office." She looked at me suspiciously, and I said, "Adam and I went to college together, and I want to surprise him. We were frat brothers at Seattle Pacific." Man, that was guy crazy. I tried to look distant, like I was conjuring up images of Adam drinking tequila from a co-ed's navel. Sunny smiled. I got the impression maybe she'd played co-ed herself. Anyway, she took the bait and shrugged. Chapter 11. Adam Gray's office was contemporary, extravagant, simply rich, or richly simple. He had two paintings, watercolors similar enough that they might have been done by the same guy on the same day. A cherry bookcase stretched the length of the near wall. The far wall was glass, providing a scenic view of a wet downtown Seattle. A long couch was nestled up to the glass, brown leather. A marble bar stood stoic in the far corner. Next to the bar was a giant aquarium. An elegant ceiling fan slowly oscillated 12 feet above an immense desk. If I ever had an office, this would be it. I went for the bar first. A crystal decanter filled with brown liquid sat beside a few ornate highball glasses. I wrestled the top off the bottle and took a sniff. Scotch. I whipped my head away. There was a mini-fridge under the bar packed with Perrier, and I snagged one. I bent down and gazed into the aquarium. 10 or 12 exotic fish swam within the blue heaven. I tapped on the glass next to a bright purple fish with black stripes. He darted to the far end of the aquarium. I think he was a rare weenie fish. I popped the top of the Perrier and made my way to the bookcase. I'd say 2/3 of the books were on law, the other third consisting of classics, motivational-type books and legal thrillers. Each book had a small tag on the back and a number. Either Adam Gray was fanatical about order or he was trying to bring back the Dewey Decimal System. 2 black filing cabinets filled the space between the bookcase and the far wall. I gave a tug on a few drawers, but they were locked. Above the filing cabinets were Gray's diplomas. Undergrad was Seattle Pacific University. Law school was Columbia. I continued on. The back wall was filled with photographs of Gray standing with some very important people, Seattle's elite. Gray with a man in a green apron, both holding what looked to be ventis in front of a Starbucks. I'd read enough tidbits off the side of my pumpkin spice lattes to know the guy's name was Howard Schultz. In another picture, Gray was hand in hand with Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, whom I only recognized because he also happened to be the owner of the Seattle Seahawks. He was like the 6th or 7th richest guy on the planet. Another pic showed Gray canoodling with the richest guy on the planet, Mr. Bill Gates. I continued down the row. There were a bunch of pictures of Gray getting chummy with some big-name athletes, Sean Alexander, Ray Allen, Gray on the tee box with Tiger, on the putting green with Lefty, Pete Sampras, Lance Armstrong, and then a couple with political figures. Bill Clinton was there. So were both the Bushes. I wondered if any of these people had pictures hanging on their walls of them with Adam Gray. Probably not. Maybe Bush Jr. I continued along the wall until I found myself nestled up near the plate glass window. It was a spectacular view. Straight out was a perfectly framed view of downtown Seattle. The Space Needle was just off center, and it dawned on me that the photograph flashing across the flat screen had been taken by Gray from this exact spot. So Adam was an amateur photographer. Good to know. The white noise of the rain splattering the window sort of put me in a trance, and I went away for a long minute. A rumble of thunder cascaded through the building, and I shook myself from the city. There was a long couch to my right. I ran my hand across the tight cinnamon leather. I plopped down and kicked my feet up on the small coffee table. A cork coaster sat in each corner of the table. One of my legs began to cramp, and I stood and faced the couch. I lifted each of the 3 cushions. The last time I did this at my place in Maine, I'd found $3 in change, 2 remotes, a CD, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and a hamster. Go figure. Anyhow, the first cushion was in pristine condition, but the undersides of the 2nd and 3rd cushions were covered with dark smears. I'd seen enough bloodstains to know I was looking at one. But then again, maybe Adam was a messy eater, and it was strawberry jelly. I replaced the cushions. I made my way to Adam's desk and plopped down in his big black leather chair. I can only assume the chair was custom-built for Adam's large frame. Nevertheless, I could have slept upright in it. On the side of the chair were 3 buttons, one of which activated a massage function. I turned the massage off and took in the desk. A telephone in one corner, a couple of those kinetic toys in another. A silver rhino paperweight sat on the front center edge. I started pulling drawers. Gray was a neat freak. Tabs, colors, files, everything in perfect order. I peered around the office. I noticed everything was oddly perfect. either Adam Gray's interior decorator at autism or Adam Gray at OCD. I put my money on the latter. Anyhow, there wasn't much left to do but wait. I leaned back in the chair, hit the massage switch, kicked my feet up onto the desk, and closed my eyes. Chapter 12.
Excuse me.
I opened my eyes. Adam Gray was standing in his doorway. He was bigger in person. He was wearing a well-cut charcoal suit. With his predominantly white hair and perfectly white goatee, he reminded me of the silver rhino at the edge of his desk. He said,
"Mind telling me what you're doing?"
"Whatsoever do you mean?" He took a couple steps forward. He grew exponentially larger. He reached the front of his desk, all 6 feet 6 inches, 230 pounds of him. He just stared at me for a while. Finally, he said,
"My receptionist says you claim we went to college together. I don't remember you."
"That's 'cause we..." I reached down and turned off the massage action, took a deep breath and continued, "That's because we didn't go to college together." He nodded confidentially to himself and said,
"I'm calling security."
These three words are in the same family as, "Look, a tiger. Is that asbestos? Clamp, please," and it turned blue. "They demand your attention." I wriggled out of the chair, stood, and said, "Actually, I'm with the FBI. I walked around the desk, extended my hand, and said, "Agent Todd Gregory." He shook my hand and said,
"Is this about my wife?"
"No, moron, it's about that parking meter incident in 93. I nodded.
"I already told you guys everything I know.
We just want to go over the details one more time." He nodded. He made his way to the doors, poked his head out, and said a couple words to Sonny. Then he closed the doors, flipped the lock, and sauntered to the bar. He picked up the decanter of scotch and looked in my direction. I shook my head. He poured himself about 3 fingers. He took a step past the aquarium, stopped like he'd been hit with an arrow in the chest, and gazed in my direction. He grabbed a cocktail napkin from the bar, dabbed it in his scotch, and cleaned the smudges on the glass. I said to his back, "Those are some expensive-looking fish." He turned and stared at me for a long second.
"Quite expensive."
I inquired as to the weenie fish. Apparently, it was called a triggerfish. The irony of this was pending. I asked, "How much does one of those go for?"
"That one, about 15.
"1,000? He nodded. I said, "I hope you got 3 wishes. He took a sip of scotch and said,
"A better short game, a Seahawks Super Bowl, and a bigger dick."
"Never to be outdone," I said. "The Tony Danza Show box set, Jessica and Nick getting back together, and a smaller dick." We both had a good laugh over this. Maybe we were long-lost frat brothers. Anyhow, I mentioned the photographs on the flat screen and said, "You snap those?" He took a sip of scotch and said,
"Sort of a hobby of mine."
"Like when you aren't defending murderers, rapists, or thugs," I almost added, "or killing your wife." He dropped the old cliché.
"Everyone is entitled to a good defense."
"Do you really believe that?"
"No,"
I nodded. Maybe he had an ounce of integrity after all. I made my way to his desk and put half my weight up on it. I picked up the silver rhino and said, "Nice desk." He stared at me. I think he was a tad uncomfortable that I was sitting on his desk and that I was touching his stuff. He managed, "Thanks. I think there were Viking ships that used less wood.
Actually, it's made from one piece of birch."
"Pricey?"
"You don't want to know."
Actually, I did, but I let it go. I placed my Perrier on his desk. In my peripheral, I could see Gray take a long sip of scotch to cover his apprehension. I was starting to get the impression Adam Gray wasn't too far off Howard Hughes. Hey, maybe that's what the filing cabinet was for, to hide his milk and pee. Gray made his way to the coffee table, picked up one of the coasters, and offered it to me. I took it from him and said, "So why did you do it?"
"Do what?"
"Good one."
"Were you sick of living in her shadow? Here you are, this big-name lawyer with millions and millions of dollars, and you are living in your wife's shadow. That's to drive a man crazy."
"Didn't bother me."
"Right.
It didn't bother him. Just like my smudges on the glass didn't bother him. Just like half my ass up on his big birch desk didn't bother him. Or the water ring I left didn't bother him. Or how I was playing slinky with his rhino didn't bother him. I mean, I could tell I made this guy's skin itch. The question was, did his wife make his skin itch? And if so, would he go so far as to kill her to stop the itching? I backed up a little. So how did you and Ellen meet? We met at a karaoke bar. He went on to tell me how he was working at some law firm fresh out of college, and he and a couple other guys went to some karaoke bar. He was on stage, hammered, doing a horrific rendition of Baby Light My Fire, when Ellen jumped on stage and rescued him. She'd been attending the college nearby. They got hitched 4 months later. I put his rhino down and crossed my arms over my chest. You're a lawyer, right? He looked at me awkwardly. I don't think he knew where I was headed with this line of reasoning, which would make two of us. My tongue was 2 seconds ahead of my brain. Yes, as an occupation, I practice law. What a lawyerly response. My brain caught up and I said, you have been hired to defend yourself. I am the jury. Convince me you didn't kill your wife. I will not. There is a state of more than 5 million people who are convinced you killed their governor. Now convince me you didn't. He stared at me for a long second. Then he walked around the back of his desk, removed his jacket, and set it neatly on his chair. He took a sip of scotch, stared at me, set the scotch down, and made his way to the rug, centering his office. I watched as he paced back and forth. Then he turned and said, did I like my wife? Not particularly. Would I have been happier without her in my life? Certainly. Did I ever think about killing her? Sure. Not exactly the best opening statement I'd ever heard, but I kept an open mind. He looked at me and said, that is exactly how 1 out of 10 men answered an online survey last fall. Of over 600,000 men polled, 1 in 10 men hate their wife and have thought about killing her. He stared at me with those green eyes and added, I wasn't one of those 1 in 10. I fought down a smile. Gray took a deep breath and said, sure, we had our problems, but what married couple doesn't? Only ours were sensationalized, magnified by the media. You get in a yelling match with your wife, and next thing you know, according to those vultures, you threw her down a flight of stairs. But we put up with it because deep down, at the core, we loved each other. I come from the old school, where the man is the breadwinner and the woman stays home with the kids, cooks, cleans, and that crap. I know it's wrong, and I know it's Orwellian 1930s rhetoric, but this is how I was brought up. I almost objected on the grounds counsel was an ignorant asshole. One day, Ellen tells me she wants to run for city council, that she can do some good for the community. 6 years later, she was the governor. I think part of me loved her for it, and part of me resented her for it. He paced back and forth for 30 seconds, then stopped. On October 15, the day Ellen went missing, I was meeting with a client on my yacht more than 2 hours from the North Cascades, where she was rumored to have been hiking. So I hardly had the means. And although our marriage was not perfect, far from it, actually, I did love my wife. And even if I didn't, I love my daughters, and I would never take their mother from them. So I certainly lack the motive. There is not one iota of evidence that ties me to her murder. There is not one iota of evidence that ties me to her murder because I had absolutely nothing to do with her murder. I found myself wanting to clap. But part of me wondered how many times he'd said the same thing to juries when he knew his client was guilty. I mean, who knew if this guy was lying? I asked, do you mind if I cross? Cross? Cross-examine you. He reluctantly took up a spot on the couch. I cracked my knuckles and conjured the image of Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. I took a deep breath and said, you have a registered 32, correct? I do. Where is it presently? It was in the glove compartment of my car. So? I told you guys my car was stolen on the Sunday before Thanksgiving. I tried to mask the fact this information was new to me. I said, tell me again. Sunday nights, I always go to this bar across the street from here. Sunday before Thanksgiving, I had a couple drinks, left around 10. I was walking to my car when something hit me in the leg. What was it? Not sure, but it's one of the last things I remember. Was it a dart? I have no idea. Could have been. Sorry, continue. He nodded. It's all sort of fuzzy. I remember something hitting me in the leg, then staggering a couple steps. That's the last thing I remember. I woke up the next day in my condo. My keys were gone and I was covered in blood. So your keys were stolen? He nodded. Keys to where? I could see him visualizing his keychain, and he said, "The house on Bainbridge, a condo I have here in town, the Jag and the yacht." "What about your office?" He pointed at the elevator and said, "That's a private elevator from the parking garage. I am the only one with access. I have a card key and there's a keypad." "How did you make it inside the condo?" "I have no idea." "Does anybody else have a key?" "I don't think so. I mean, not that I know of." I smiled. This was the first time he'd lied. I made a chalk mark. I asked, "You said you were covered in blood when you woke up?" "Yeah. I had a cut on my cheek and a large cut on the side of my head. My shirt was covered in blood. It felt like I had been thrown down a flight of stairs." "Maybe you were." "Maybe." "Did you contact the police?" "I reported the car stolen." That would be easy to check, so I had to assume he was telling the truth. I backed up a bit and said, "You said that on the day your wife disappeared, you were on your yacht with your client." "That's correct." "Is there anybody else who saw you?" "No, that's why we decided to meet there." "So other than your client vouching for you, a person whose life you basically have in the palm of your hand, you don't have an alibi?" He found this amusing. "Do you know how much an hour of my time costs?" "I don't know. $300? "Try $2,000. I raised my eyebrows. "We were together 10 hours. If he's lying, then it's costing him 20 large. He added, "Plus my client hates my guts. He'd kill me before he vouched for me." I tried a different strategy. "So were you or your wife having any clandestine affairs?" He was. I wasn't sure about her. He was taken aback by this and stammered, "No, of course not." I made another chalk mark. "Did your wife find out you were fucking someone on the side?" He stood up. "I think it's time you leave." I pointed to his couch and said, "Did your wife even know about your condo? Or was that where you took your mistress? Or hell, maybe it was Sunny, you know, your receptionist. She's a real smart one. You get her from a temp agency? Or were you sticking it to her and decided to get her a job when a spot opened up?" Evidently, I'd hit a nerve. He whipped a phone from his pocket and said, "Security." I pointed to the couch. "Why even go to the condo when you have a couch right here? Hell, you could screw her brains out between clients." He looked at me and said, "You aren't an FBI agent, are you?" I shook my head. "Who are you?" I was set to say, "I'm your worst nightmare," but there was a knock at the door and a man yelled, "Security, is everything okay in there?" Adam started for the door. I took 2 steps to my right and hit the elevator call button. The doors opened silently and I slipped inside. The last thing I saw was the door crashing open and 3 men in black uniforms barging in. Then the elevator door slid shut. 20 seconds later, I was back in the rain. Chapter 13. The next day, I decided to surprise Harold. I stopped by the supermarket and picked up a bunch of items I thought he might enjoy. I went through the same routine with the prune at the front desk, who appeared to have dehydrated even more, if possible. Her jowls now had jowls, just saying. Harold came to the door. He said, "Where you been?" He looked 5 years older. I handed him his bag of goodies. He smiled, or tried to. His lips no longer appeared to take orders from his brain, but he smiled with his eyes. He perused his gift bag as I watched horse racing. Harold seemed especially interested in the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. I imagine if he was capable of popping a boner, it would have killed him. Anyhow, it was right around lunchtime, and I sort of hinted that I would like to see what the cafeteria looked like. The cafeteria was about the size of a small classroom. There were pre-made items, fun size, of course, plus a woman dishing out the meal of the day. According to the calendar at the entrance, it was Salisbury steak and macaroni. Actually, it appeared to be Salisbury steak and macaroni month. The line moved slowly. This might have something to do with the fact that every other person was using a walker or a wheelchair, or that the lady who broke her hip was trying to filch an extra jello portion, or that one of the CNN aisles demanded his Salisbury steak be blessed by a rabbi. When we were almost finished eating, one of the waitresses dropped 2 pieces of white bread wrapped in cellophane on the table next to Harold. He quickly grabbed the slices and tossed them in the basket of his walker. After lunch, Harold and I retired to the common area and played a couple games of checkers. Harold played a combination of checkers, backgammon, badminton, chess, and chutes and ladders. Needless to say, he won both games. At one point, when he thought I wasn't looking, he took 3 of my pieces and put them in his pocket. I guess when you get to be 130, you no longer worry about karma. Afterward, Harold told me to follow him, so I followed him out the back doors and onto a narrow paved path. About 100 yards down the walkway was a small lake surrounded by large oaks. A fountain was spraying at the far edge of the lake, and 2 or 3 groups of ducks paddled in the current. There was a small break in the weather, the sun poking its head through the clouds, but I had the feeling we would be here regardless of the conditions. We covered the 100 yards in a little under 5 minutes. Nestled near the lake was a small bench, and Harold flopped down onto it. He sat there with his eyes closed and took long, deep inhales on his oxygen tank. I sat next to him. Harold opened his eyes, took the bread from his walker basket, and unwrapped it. He handed a piece to me. I ripped off a piece of the bread and threw it in my mouth. "The bread is for the ducks," Harold voiced sternly. And here I'd been under the impression Harold and I were going to eat Wonder Bread and talk shop. So the two of us sat there and ripped off little pieces of bread and tossed them to the ducks. Every time a duck would choke down a piece of bread, the old man's eyes would light up. If a couple ducks fought over the same piece of bread, the old man would laugh and shake his head, only to fall into a coughing fit. After about 20 minutes, Harold broke the silence. He said, "The lake wasn't much bigger than this." I wasn't sure exactly what he was talking about for a long second. Then it hit me. We were back in 1942. I turned my attention from the ducks to my friend on my left. I said, "Right, the girl had just fallen through the ice." Harold watched as the little girl flapped around in the icy hole. Why was he watching? Shouldn't he do something? He went to open the door on the Model T Ford. His hand was shaking, but he got the door open. He remembered seeing a long rope in the trunk of the small truck when he had tossed his bag in earlier that morning. His dad used the rope for this and that. The last time it was used, another truck had to pull theirs from a rivulet in the mud. Harold leapt into the back of the truck and found the long rope. It was still covered in mud from months earlier, but it would do. He wrapped the rope around his bulging forearm and shoulder, trading quick glances at the frantic girl. He watched as her head disappeared under the water, only to reemerge a second later. Harold couldn't think of a longer second in his life. He jumped out of the back of the truck, ran across the street, hopped over the small fence, and made his way to the edge of the lake. The girl was no more than 40 feet from him. He guessed the rope was much longer than that, probably even double. The girl was facing away from him. He guessed she'd been in the water for 30 seconds, maybe longer. Harold screamed at the girl. After 2 or 3 more yells, she turned to him. Her face was a whitish blue. Harold could see the fight draining from her body. He had to act fast. He yelled, "I'm gonna get you out of there." He couldn't tell if she heard him or not. He yelled, "I'm gonna throw you the rope. Grab it and pull yourself out." Harold found these words silly. How could this girl possibly pull herself out? She'd be lucky if she could get her freezing hands to grip the rope. He thought about going out onto the ice himself, but if he fell in, then he was dead along with the girl. He let out a long distance of rope and threw it out onto the ice and made it about 2/3 of the way. He cursed. The girl clung to the side of the ice, her hands frantically moving along the ice's edge. Then a piece of the ice chipped off and the girl disappeared. She met Harold's gaze as she slipped under the water. Harold decided he would not be the last image this young girl saw. He tied one end of the rope around a fence post, tied the other snugly around his waist, and ran onto the ice. The ice was thick for the first 20 feet, then became increasingly transparent as he neared the sloshing breach. He came abreast of the hole and stared down into the blackness. Then the ice gave way around him. The sensation was more like being thrown into a fire than anything else. His body didn't know what to do. His brain turned off. Then a second later, it flickered back on. The girl. He flipped over in the icy water and kicked his feet downward. He found even the slightest of motions were nearly impossible, like the messages from his brain were rerouted, missing their stops. He opened his eyes, but the blackness he saw was darker than if he had his eyes closed. He clamped his eyes shut and kicked down another couple feet. He moved his hands in every direction, but freezing water is all that touched back. Harold knew he only had a couple seconds left to get to the surface. That's when he felt the touch on his left arm, just the lightest touch, but a touch that warned him, filled him with fire. He found her hand, then her arm, then he had his arms clasped around her. Then he kicked for the surface, kicked harder than he'd ever kicked in his life. He didn't know how far they traveled. It felt like a mile, maybe 2. Then his head broke the surface. His first thought wasn't to breathe. It was the girl. Her head was limp and she was bluer than the sky. He wasn't sure if she was alive or dead. Harold was strong as an ox from working 15-hour days in the fields, but all his strength had been stripped. He wasn't sure if he would be able to pull himself from the icy waters, let alone the girl. For the first time in a long time, Harold said a quick prayer. That's when she coughed. Just the tiniest of coughs, but a cough nonetheless. Then her eyes opened. Harold yelled, "I need you to wrap your arms around my back." The girl's teeth chattered, and she was able to nod just slightly. She made her way around Harold. Two thin arms